and we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, September the 16th. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Caroline Carnery.
Pleasure to be here.
And our guest co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
Welcome, everyone. Next Thursday, September the 22nd, marks National Elephant Appreciation Day. And I think elephants need to be appreciated and understood better, too. So today's show is dedicated to the elephants. For our first interview, we'll be speaking with Fran Duffy. She is a local animal advocate and co-founder of the organization called Elephanatics. Her mission is to raise awareness to the public about the challenges and suffering that the endangered elephants face in both Africa and Asia. The Global March for Elephants and Rhinos takes place next Saturday, September the 23rd, and Elephanatics is organizing a Vancouver edition of the event. She'll be here on the show to tell us about the event and some of the issues facing the endangered elephants today. Then for our feature interview, we have Victoria-based filmmaker Patricia Sims on the show. Patricia is also an advocate for the elephants and has made two films that cover the domineering relationships that exist between humans and elephants in Asia and how there may be hope to save the elephants in Thailand. Her most recent film, called When Elephants Were Young, debuted just last month, and Patricia will be on the show today to speak to us about her film and some of the issues it addresses. That interview is coming up in about 31 minutes, so please do stay tuned for that. So last weekend, we had about 200 animal advocates that came out in Vancouver to participate in our first march to close all slaughterhouses, and Caroline and I were there.
And I thought it was absolutely electric, the energy flowing between all the activists. You know, when you sign up for one of these events, you hope and hope and hope that people will come out in the numbers that they say they're going to come out in, and you hope that you don't arrive to having 10 people. But in fact, when we arrived, there were at least 150 to 200 people on site. Yeah. And it was just so exciting to be able to meet a lot of new activists and to really celebrate the lives of animals. So we were walking down Robson and across Denman and up Davie and back, all starting at the and ending at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
It was a really long walk.
And it was long, and my voice was quite dead after it. And we were, you know, making chants about animal liberation, equality of all animals, justice for animals, and meat ablation. In this march to close all slaughterhouses. And, you know, it was so exciting to see people coming by and honking their horns in support, and those people on the sidewalks giving us support and coming out onto their balconies from above, especially on Davie Street. What is this noise? Who are these people in these red shirts? And, yeah, it was just fantastic. Now, Allison, you were leafleting.
Yeah, we had a bunch of people actually that were handing out a variety of different vegan and animal rights related literature to people who are passing by, because that's one way to get the word out, right? And I have to say, you know, I've done leafleting at the Pride parades in the past, vegan leafleting. And at those parades, we have like, there's over 100,000 people. They're all packed in the streets and they all want to take what you have, right? Mm-hmm. This was a little bit different. You know, it wasn't, it was basically just a bunch of really loud people in the streets. And I'm sure just the average person would wonder, like, what are these people, right? As you were saying, like, who are these people in the red shirts? And do I want whatever like propaganda they have to give to me? Mm-hmm. So the way I approach it is I'm always very friendly, and I say, would you like one? And I put it out, and he was smiling. And most people I found took the brochures, they took the leaflets. I felt I had more success than some of the people that were doing it alongside of me. Mm-hmm. I made a point to really approaching people who maybe you wouldn't think would typically, like, I don't know, kind of like men looking stern with their arms crossed. And then I go, would you like one? And they actually, I would say like 90% of the time they were taking these leaflets. And I think that's just the first step. Like, that could plant a seed in their head. To, you know, the messages in those brochures are just very, I think, accessible for people because it all makes sense.
That's the idea, is to plant the seeds, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And this event started years ago in France and now has spread to 18 cities, France, Germany, Australia, the United States, Belgium, Japan. There was one a few months ago in Toronto and then now in Vancouver here in Canada. So I'm so excited. And after the event, when we our small group, a group of us, I should say, because we were a large group. We went in different directions to kind of debrief and eat some food. And our group, our small group, went over to Virtuous Pie, and we flowed right on in the door there and took the joint over. And Virtuous Pie is our latest
and greatest
vegan pizza shop.
And ice cream.
And ice cream as well.
What could be a better combination, right?
And let me just revisit what one of the first things I sat at a table with a guy who said to me about the march, this march has taken me from being a vegan to being an activist. And I got chills. I mean, that's just exactly we want. Being vegan is wonderful. Being a vegan activist is more wonderful, of course. So very excited. So we all ordered our pies, and mine was delicious. I shared two pizzas. I got the Mediterranean falafel pizza with baba ganoush and falafel and feta, vegan feta, of course, calamari and chutney. And I split also with my partner a super fungi cashew mozzarella.
Oh, I tried that one too. That is so good.
Oh, I can ask you about a report. So that's good. Cashew mozzarella, scalloped potatoes, truffle almond ricotta, wild mushrooms. And Allison,
this sounds better than regular non-plant-based pizza, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't it? I mean, it's just more interesting.
And more flavorful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you think of yours,
Shay? It was really good. Yeah, I had the super fungi with the wild mushrooms and stuff. And they had the arugula on top. And they had fresh basil in the window that they're picking and putting on everyone's pizzas. And I went in on Tuesday afternoon at about 3 o'clock, and I thought that would be a pretty safe time. It would be pretty chill, but it was packed in there. It was so busy.
I love that.
Yeah. Oh, man. But I stood outside and waited patiently for my pizza while I ate my ice cream, which was delicious. The coffee and donuts was awesome, and the waffle cone.
And that is, to clarify, the flavor of your ice cream was called coffee and donuts.
Yes, that's right.
What does coffee and donuts taste like in an ice cream?
Well, it tastes pretty good. To put it simply, yes. Yeah, it was really, really rich, really intense, though. Yeah, coconut is what they use to make the ice cream, I believe.
Oh, dear. What are we all doing after the show? Is my stomach starting?
Okay, so this is like, we can declare pizza and ice cream down at Virtuous Pie every Friday after the show. Right. Now, actually, I was already thinking that. It's not that far. It's located at 583 Main Street in Chinatown, so we definitely recommend that you check it out.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food. Sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food. Hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
All right, so we've got a few events to talk about today. The first one is this Sunday for any listeners in Victoria. You can catch one of three screenings of the new documentary When Elephants Were Young at the UVic Cine Centre in Victoria. The showtimes are 3:15, 5:15, and 7:15, and after the 7:15 show, there will be a Q&A with filmmaker Patricia Sims, who also is the co-founder of World Elephant Day and who we will be interviewing later on the show. So if you can't make those screenings in Victoria on Sunday, then at least stick around for that interview a little later on the show.
And Elephantics is hosting the third annual Mardi Gras for Elephants and Rhinos on Saturday, September the 24th at Creekside Park, 1455 Quebec Street, Vancouver, noon till 1:30 p.m. Now, the poaching of elephants and rhinos has reached unprecedented heights in recent years as the demand for ivory and rhino horn has soared in China and other Asian markets. An elephant is, and these statistics are just unbelievable, an elephant is brutally killed every 15 minutes, 35,000 every year, and there are less than 400,000 left. A rhino is poached every 11 hours, over 1,000 every year, and less than 2,400 left. So this is about urgently raising awareness and taking immediate global action. And last year, over 50,000 people gathered in over 130 cities around the world to demand an end to the poaching crisis. We want to contribute to those numbers. And it's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of family fun. There'll be face painting, live music, and an elephant mask craft table. This year's speaker will include one of our guests today, Patricia Sims, the filmmaker and co-founder of World Elephant Day. And to find out more, you can go to their website, www.elephantics.org.
All right, there's another event next Sunday, September 25th, downtown. Some activists are getting together at Vancouver City Centre Station to stage an Earthlings experience and do some leafleting before Thanksgiving. And for those who aren't familiar, an Earthlings experience is when people get together with laptops or tablets and they stand in a public space and screen the documentary Earthlings for people walking by to raise awareness of the suffering of the animals that we exploit and just put it right out there for them. So yeah, if you're interested in getting involved with that, that's on Sunday, September 25th at 2 p.m. at Vancouver City Centre Station. That's at Granville and Georgia. And if you don't have a laptop or a tablet to screen the documentary, then they also need people just leafleting and doing outreach and talking to people. So by all means, go down there and check it out.
Okay, and our next event is super fun. It is the Worldwide Vegan Chalk Challenge. That's Chalk. Yay. October 1st and 2nd. And this is happening any place, everywhere. Please join us for this worldwide effort to help spread the vegan message. Chalktivism is easy and fun, and if enough people get involved, it will be newsworthy, and that's what we're going for. So let's drop a vegan chalk bomb on the world. The idea is simple. You buy chalk, which you can get at Walmart or Target or on Amazon for about $5 a box. You write a positive vegan message in a public space, and then you post your pictures on social media along with the hashtag #VeganChalkChallenge. So invite all your friends to share in this event. You can find out more information and get inspiration at www.veganchalkchallenge.org. And of course, you don't have to wait until October to start. And this event will coincide with World Day for Farmed Animals on October the 2nd.
If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
For our first interview, we have Fran Duthie on the show. She is the co-founder of a group called Elephantatics, which is a local elephant advocacy organization located here in Vancouver. Its mission is to help the long-term survival of African and Asian elephants by raising awareness and disseminating information regarding the challenges and suffering elephants face in Africa's poaching crisis and in Asia's tourist trade. The Global March for Elephants and Rhinos takes place worldwide next Saturday, September the 24th, and Elephantatics will be hosting the Vancouver edition that day. Fran is here today to tell us about the event and also some of the work that her organization does to educate. Hello, Fran, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Oh, hello, Allison, and thank you so much for inviting me, and happy Elephant Appreciation Day.
Well, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show today. I'm excited to have you here to speak about some of the work of Elephantatics. Now, I wonder if you could start a bit by just telling us a bit more about your organization and what you do to educate the community on crises facing elephants.
Yeah, sure. We formed Elephantatics about 4 years ago. It was the four of us, and our main pillars of strength are conservation, education, and action. My focus is mainly on the education and action of things, and the conservation is handled by Dr. Jake Wall, our research scientist, who is also a co-founder and works for Save the Elephants, which is a large NGO in Kenya. I have done numerous classroom presentations to grades 3 to 7, both here in Greater Vancouver and San Diego. We have also given Pro-D Day talks to teachers and many volunteer and career fairs. We have connected with some wonderful teachers and students who are more than willing to get involved with our organization and help spread awareness.
And so when you're doing these presentations in the schools, can you tell us a bit more about, like, what issues are you educating them on with regards to elephants?
Sure. Yes, my presentations deal mainly with the younger children. I go in and I read them the book called The Hunter. And it deals with a little girl who lives in Africa who wants to be a hunter. And then after she realizes she is being tracked like a baby elephant, she realizes she doesn't want to be a hunter any longer. And it just invokes some thoughts into children's minds about the poaching crisis and how that works on a non-graphic manner. My market is aimed at children for a good reason. They are our next generation of thinkers and doers, and we rely on them to make the changes necessary to stop elephants and rhinos from possibly becoming extinct. I found education as a key proponent in changing minds and bringing awareness to necessary causes. I know when my children brought home ideas they learned at school on certain initiatives, I listened. Yeah, to me, it starts at school and with the kids, and I've been lucky enough to be able to get into some classrooms and give presentations and get questions from kids that are far beyond most people's expectations for their age level.
Well, I've learned some interesting facts over this week, actually quite astonishing. For example, 100 African elephants are slaughtered each day for ivory. And then there's the rhino issue as well, which I'm not very familiar with. Another thing that I read last night is that both elephants and rhinos could be facing extinction in 10 years. So because our listeners, I don't think, know very much about rhinos at all, can you please tell us about that and what they're being poached
for? Yes, definitely. It's very disheartening. Every 15 minutes, an elephant is being slaughtered. The Great Elephant Census that was just released by Microsoft CEO Paul Allen was grimmer than expected. There's only 352,000 savanna elephants left. That's a 30% decline and a rate of 8% per year, primarily due to poaching. The rhinos face just as big trouble. Since 2008, poachers have killed at least 6,000 African rhinos. South Africa at one point had the largest population, but poaching has drastically reduced their numbers. Rhinos were abundant in Africa and Asia, approximately 500,000 worldwide in the 1990s, but at least 1,300 were poached for the horn last year in Africa alone. They suffer sometimes, their faces are hacked off and left to die. The Western black rhino was declared extinct by the International Union for Conservation of Nature in 2011. With the primary cause being poaching. In fact, all 5 remaining rhinos species are on the international conservation list. The frustrating thing is that many people in China and Vietnam believe the horn will cure many illnesses from cancer to hangovers to impotency. In reality, rhino horn is made of keratin, the same substance as our fingernails, and it's absolutely useless for any medicinal purposes whatsoever. It is also a status symbol because of its high value. It's worth more than gold.
Fran, I understand that there's a private member's bill called Bill M234 that has been brought forward to ban the sale of ivory and rhino horn in BC. This has been put forward by Mike Farnworth. He's an NDP MLA for Port Coquitlam. Can you tell us a bit more about that, please?
Yes, we were very pleased to be approached by Mike Farnworth. Actually, he got in touch with me, and he came to our march a couple of times, and he's basically proposed a new legislation that sees BC exercise its jurisdiction as a subnational government to help close the domestic market for these animal parts. This bill will help to close loopholes that permit trade in ivory and rhino horns derived from animals predating Canada's ratification of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. We hope with this legislation, BC will join a growing global effort to curb wildlife trafficking, such as the U.S. has done recently with their domestic ivory ban.
The Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, otherwise known as CITES, begins on September 24th next week in Johannesburg. Now, I wonder, just for our listeners who don't know what CITES is, can you tell us about what it is and who it's made up of? And then what do you hope will be happening at this convention next week with regards to elephants and rhinos?
Sure. CITES is the International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, just as you said. It's a voluntary international agreement between 183 governments. Its aim is to ensure that international trade in species of wild animals and plants does not threaten their survival. The International Union for Conservation of Nature upholds the agreement with the aim to ensure that 35,000 species of wild animals and plants are not threatened by their trade internationally. CITES is legally binding on the current members, being 183 countries plus the European Union. CITES provides three levels of protection for species. Appendix 3 is the lowest level of protection. It contains species that are protected at least one country, which has asked other CITES parties for assistance in controlling the trade. Appendix 2 means that species are not necessarily threatened with extinction, but may become so if trade isn't strictly regulated. And Appendix 1 means that species are offered the highest degree of protection and lists those species which are threatened with extinction. We are addressing and writing and demanding that CITES complete closure of domestic and international markets for ivory and a total ban on the ivory trade, including the rejection of any one-off sales as in 2008, to list all species of elephant on Appendix 1, that means the highest amount of protection, to reject Swaziland's proposal to sell its stockpile of rhino horn and open up trade in horn, and, given the opportunity, list all species of rhino on Appendix 1, and list all species of lion on Appendix 1, ending the trade in lion bone as well. That's what we wish.
Let's hope it happens. So things are happening. Like earlier this year, the U.S. just declared a near total ban on the importation of ivory. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about on this ban and perhaps how it can translate to what might happen here in Canada. And what's the situation in Canada at this time with regards to importation of ivory and rhino horn too?
Okay, I'll address all of those. The U.S. ivory ban will legally close most ivory trade in the U.S. to protect elephants. It essentially prohibits all commercial import, export, and interstate trade of African elephant ivory, with some narrow exceptions. These exceptions include commercial export and interstate trade of items that meet the Endangered Species Act, like the antique exemption criteria, and interstate trade of certain manufactured or handcrafted items that contain a small amount of legally imported ivory. We as Canadians have a duty, I feel, to prevent the extinction of two of the most iconic and majestic species on Earth. The elephant is a keystone species responsible for the lives of many other ecosystems. We have to let our Canadian CITES delegation know that Canadians want elephants to exist. I believe with the implementation of stricter laws and regulations to close down loopholes, we can achieve this. Our governing body is set out in our Wild Animal and Plant Protection and Regulation of International and Interprovincial Trade Act. Environment Canada is responsible to administer and enforce laws that prohibit or strictly limit the importation and sale of elephant products in Canada as set out in the Act. WAPRITA, which is the abbreviation for Wild Animal and Plant Protection Regulation Act, allows for extremely limited importation and sale of products in Canada, however. So loopholes in the laws have allowed black market trades and other traders and others to import and sell in Canada elephant products that are strictly prohibited.
The Global March for Elephants and Rhinos will be taking place in cities worldwide next Saturday, September the 24th. You'll be hosting a march here in Vancouver that day. You're calling it a Mardi Gras and celebration of life. Can you please tell us about this event and what people can expect to find there?
Sure. Last 2 years, we have done a march. This year, we are doing a rally as opposed to marching. We are basically having a family-friendly rally with speakers and fun activities and music and different events going on. There's actually 145 cities marching globally this year. If you're interested, if you're out of town listening to this show, perhaps you can go on marchforelephantsandrhinos.org. It's a website that you can look up to see if your city is holding a rally or a march, and you can join in yourself. Ours is a free admission, family-friendly event. And it's a Mardi Gras theme because we wanted to bring awareness to the life of the elephants and rhinos as opposed to the negative slaughtering of them. We need to celebrate what is left of the remaining elephants and rhinos. So we wanted to have more of a fun-based theme with speakers that will be directly talking about the issues that are pertain to the crisis of the elephant and rhino.
And finally, what can our listeners do as individuals at home to help the elephants and rhinos in these far-off continents? What are some actions that people can take?
Well, one thing they can do is go online and on our blog, on our website, www.elephantaddicts.org, on our blog section, we have a letter to CITES, which it's an online petition you can sign, which is to ban the domestic and international trade in ivory. You can sign that. That would be a great help. Come to our Mardi Gras and have some fun and learn about the crisis facing the elephant and rhino. And you can give to projects spending 100% of your donation on elephant protection, like the Elephant Crisis Fund that we are donating our funds to this year.
Well, thank you, Fran, for joining us on the show today to tell us more about the work that Elephant Addicts does to advocate on behalf of the elephants. To find out more about Elephant Addicts and the work they do, check out their website, elephantaddicts.org, and the Mardi Gras for Elephants and Rhinos happens next Saturday, September 24th at noon at Creekside Park in Vancouver beside Science World. Also, the petition to CITES has been posted on our Facebook page as well, Animal Voices Vancouver, and I'll put it on our website as well at animalvoices.org. Thanks so much for coming today, Fran, and speaking to us about these issues, and happy Elephant Appreciation Day to you as well.
Oh, I can't thank you enough for your time, Allison, and I hope to see you at our rally.
And now for the news, and we have some very, very good news indeed to start our news program today. California has banned orca breeding and captivity programs. I feel like we should just let that sink in for a minute.
Yay.
Because it's so overwhelming. So Government Jerry Brown signed legislation Tuesday in California that will outlaw orca breeding and captivity programs like the one formerly run by SeaWorld. California parks will also be banned from featuring the marine mammals in performances for entertainment purposes. Starting in June next year, the law authored by Assemblyman Richard Bloom makes exceptions for scientific and educational institutions holding orcas for research and or rehabilitation. So I'm always a bit concerned when I see these exceptions and how they could possibly be exploited. But for now, this is a very good day for activists, for who have worked so hard, mm-hmm. for the makers of Blackfish who brought that film into, you know, to the common person sitting in their living room at home through Netflix. And just such great news for the whales.
Right on. On the topic of our show, elephants, then there's definitely some news going on with the ivory trade. So last weekend, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the IUCN, put forward a motion for every country to ban their internal trade of ivory in order to protect elephants from extinction. And, you know, there were only four countries that objected the motion. There was South Africa, Namibia, Japan, and Canada. So so what's up with that, right? But Canada argued that the ivory ban would affect the hunting of walrus and narwhal by the Inuit in the Canadian Arctic. And frankly, when I read that, I just thought, like, so Canada jumps to step up for Indigenous rights when it's something they can make money off of, but all the other times it's just like, whatever, I don't know. Anyway, the IUCN motion is not legally binding, but aims to encourage a commitment to both international and domestic ban of ivory trade at the upcoming CITES conference in Johannesburg this October. So Canada hasn't made it clear exactly what kinds of protections they are going to propose for elephants at that conference. So I guess we'll find out.
It's time to write our governments again, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And let them know how we feel about that. And by now, many of us have heard about the St. Catharines, Ontario veterinarian who was caught on video punching and choking animals at his hospital. The alleged animal abuse was brought to light by former employees of the Skyway Animal Hospital, who were outraged that the veterinarian, Dr. Mahavir Singh Reiki, was handed a 10-month suspension in August for professional misconduct by the College of Veterinarians of Ontario. And they're really quite angry that Reiki must only complete a series of mentorship sessions concerning the proper handling of animals. And then he is also eligible for a reduction of his suspension down to 4 months. Other than that, the vet's license is not impaired. Now, authorities were alerted to these actions after four former employees of the Skyway Animal Hospital secretly videotaped him, the vet, Reiki, choking, improperly restraining, and once striking a dog in the snout with a nail clipper over the course of 3 years. So this is clearly a pattern of abuse. And the animal law group Animal Justice has filed a complaint with the Ontario Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals and the Niagara Falls Humane Society, calling for animal cruelty charges to be laid against the vet. Now, yesterday, the OSPCA announced it had indeed launched a formal investigation into his practice. And if an investigation is brought under the Criminal Code of Canada, the maximum charge is 5 years in prison for an indictable offense of cruelty to animals. And to learn more and to wage in on the petition to urge the College of Vets in Ontario to invoke greater consequences to this vet for regarding his license to practice, you can check out the Animal Justice website or their Facebook page.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Our feature interview is with Victoria filmmaker Patricia Sims. Patricia is the founder of World Elephant Day and has also produced documentaries around the world focusing on nature and conservation education and the interrelationships between humans and animals. Her most recent film, When Elephants Were Young, was just released last month, and it explores new strategies for the future of human-elephant relations and the survival of all elephants. Patricia is here today to tell us about about the film and some of the issues facing the Asian elephants today. Hello, Patricia, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show. It's great to have you here. Thank you for being on the show today to speak with us about your recently released film, When Elephants Were Young. I was so moved by the film when I watched it this week. I think it was beautifully done, so thank you for making it. And I wonder if you could start by giving our listeners a summary of the story that the film tells and what inspired you to make the film.
Well, thanks. I'm so glad you had a chance to see it. Well, I started on elephant issues, I guess, probably going back maybe 7-8 years now. And as I learned more about the complexity of issues that were facing elephants around the world, I found also that one of the most interesting things was the long history that we've had with elephants. Human civilization has had with elephants for almost 4,000 years. And as I started to research, I learned more about that relationship in Thailand. And Thailand actually is a country where many people first encounter Asian elephants. And so that's what took me there, my research. And through that research, discovered the very tragic story of street begging with elephants that was going on in Bangkok at the time. And in finding out about that, we ended up meeting up with Wok and Nong Mai, who are the two main characters of our film, and their situation and the family situation that Wok was undergoing in their street begging operation in Bangkok using elephants. So it was a bit of a long journey to get to that point, but once we fell into that and met them and gained their trust, and told them we wanted to make a film about their lives, basically that's what started the project and led me to the last 5 years of my life making it.
Wow. And there are 2,800 captive elephants in Thailand, as the film says, and only 1,200 wild elephants. The Asian elephant is marked as endangered. Can you talk to us about just the situation for people in Thailand? And you mentioned street begging. What else are they specifically using elephants for to benefit their livelihoods? Just because I think people may not be fully aware of this.
Yes, well, as I mentioned, there's a long, long history of elephants' involvement in human civilization, and this goes back, you know, to not just Thailand, but throughout Asia and in some parts of Africa. You know, elephants have been used in warfare. They've been used in agriculture and industry and basically as beasts of burden. For many years, elephants were used in the logging industry in Thailand. And that was a significant livelihood for many families who, coming from the long tradition of elephant capture and elephant trade, as you saw in the film, you learned of the Gue people, who are one of the ethnic groups in that region that have had this long tradition of being connected with elephants. And so for many, many decades, families were earning livings through using elephants in the logging industry. That actually had been going on just up until, I guess, about a year and a half, 2 years ago in Myanmar as well. Myanmar was still one of the last remaining places on the planet where elephants were used in the logging industry. But when that happened in Thailand, when the logging industry was banned in 1989, primarily because there were no more trees to log, and that was actually set by the king of Thailand, there ended up being a lot of elephants that were in captive circumstances that couldn't really be cared for properly because there was no livelihood attached to their care. And it's expensive to care for an elephant. I mean, if you have an elephant living with you, many of these families have a few elephants living with them, it becomes quite expensive. And so the tourism industry, although elephants had already been very popular in tourism in earlier years, it really, really proliferated from the late 80s on and really grew into what it is today, which is one of the main underpinnings of the Thai tourism industry. So the livelihoods for people now in Thailand predominantly rest in different forms of tourism. And they're not used very much at all now in any other forms of industry or occupation. There's no more elephants used in logging legally, and there's no more use of elephants in any other form of real agricultural activities. So it's predominantly tourism and entertainment for humans.
Such as playing soccer and painting. I know that I've seen videos online of these elephants painting these beautiful photos, but what most people don't know is what the captivity that lies behind all of this issue. Now, our co-host Sinead here has a question for you.
Sure.
Yeah, in the film, author and Asian elephant specialist Richard Lair said that animal rights activists, they get a lot of animal rights activists discouraging people from riding elephants or going to elephant shows without realizing that this, as he says in the film, is, quote, the only legal form of work in Thailand, unquote. So what exactly does he mean by this? And can we discourage people from perpetuating elephant exploitation without dismissing the desperate situations of the humans exploiting them?
Yes. In fact, what Richard's referring to is what I just mentioned about the shift that happened in Thailand from logging to tourism. And with that also grew a certain amount of illegal logging activity that still carried on for many years, mostly around the Thai-Myanmar border. And the capture and trade of elephants from the wild for sale into other countries for use in zoos and circuses. So those activities, those latter two, are not technically legal activities, but they had been going on for these last few decades. So the only real way of earning a living with elephants in Thailand illegally is to work with them into some form of tourism or some form of activity that's allowed through the various ministries that oversee the care and welfare of elephants in Thailand in captivity. And that's quite a complex issue because that runs through a number of different ministries in Thailand, how actually elephants are managed and cared for between wild elephants and captive elephants. And one of the things that a number of groups in Thailand are working on trying to change to simplify a lot of that sort of legislation that will hopefully eventually enforce better care and management of elephants in captivity. But to answer your question, is there anything that tourists can do? Yes, absolutely. And this has been one of the main thrusts of our work and our campaign around the release of the film. And around what we launched with World Elephant Day this year. I'm not sure if you might be aware that I'm the founder of World Elephant Day, which we launched in 2012. World Elephant Day is an annual global awareness day, like an Earth Day for elephants. It brings awareness to the elephant issues. So this year when we released When Elephants Were Young, we released it on World Elephant Day, and the main focus of our campaign was exactly this, to bring awareness to how elephants are being treated in captivity. There's more and more places now that are starting to recognize that tourists, particularly Western tourists, much prefer a more natural, educational encounter with elephants rather than seeing elephants perform in a ring doing tricks and elephant trekking. And, you know, again, elephant trekking, that's also a bit of a complex issue. Traditionally, elephants have been ridden and used, as I mentioned earlier, you know, centuries ago in warfare and even among the traditional elephant-keeping families. And in those circumstances, done properly, cared for properly, and it's not ultimately a detrimental activity for elephants. Where it has become a problem is this huge increase in frenzy, if you will, of people wanting to go and meet elephants, and then they want to go and they have an elephant ride, and they think it's great to be on the back of an elephant in these big howdahs, and howdahs is the name that's referred to those big kind of box saddles that they sit in. But because the growth in the tourism industry and obviously tourist operators want to make as much money as possible, so they turn around these elephant treks really, really quickly. They put too many people into the howdahs. They don't give elephants the time to rest properly after trekking. The howdahs aren't fitted on the elephants properly. The elephants are awfully overworked and dehydrated. So there's many, many things that have actually occurred to hurt elephants, essentially, through this overuse of them in trekking circumstances. So one of the things we've really wanted to bring awareness to is this fact, and to really, really persuade people who want to have experiences with elephants in a natural way to seek out these places that really care for elephants in a natural and educational kind of capacity, not forcing them to perform and do tricks. So this is a main focus for us, and there are more of these places now that are starting to open up in Thailand, in Cambodia, in Malaysia, in Bali. There's a few places now, even through into Indonesia, Sri Lanka, where there's more awareness about how elephants live together, what works best for elephants, and what's the best way for people to interact with them in captive circumstances. I mean, certainly the best way to see elephants is in the wild. I mean, that's, you know, the real true way of seeing elephants behave with each other, their natural social bonds in wild circumstances. But unfortunately, as we have learned with Asian elephants, the biggest issue for them is loss of their habitat. So it's becoming harder and harder to see Asian elephants in the wild. And that's one of the other issues that we're very focused on as well. So lots of stuff, lots of complexity on mm-hmm. what are the best steps. How do we continue living and working with elephants in these captive circumstances? And how do we provide the opportunities for them to be protected in the wild or return to the wild, as you see in our film, is one of the real positive conservation organizations that we're connected with in Thailand, the Elephant Reintroduction Foundation.
Yeah, and these relationships between these elephants and their human captors or keepers are called mahouts. It's noted as an extremely bizarre situation in the film. And as you were saying, it goes back many, many years. It actually goes back to Paleolithic times, these relationships. And I have to say that I was questioning myself how and why these gigantic and intelligent beings could allow themselves to be domineered by humans for human use. And I wonder if you can tell us about this as to how that works and from your perspective, how that elephant-human relationship plays out in Thailand between the elephants and their mahouts. And how, why is it that, in your opinion, that they accept this dominance by humans?
Well, that's a very complex discussion, because we have to then consider what the elephant brain is and what the elephant cognitive, emotional, behavioral processing is to understand how they relate with a human captor, or in the case with the mahout, caretaker, or however we want to refer to the human component of that relationship. And we don't really know fundamentally what the elephant experiences. I mean, there's been a lot that's been written and shown about how, in many cases, the elephant training process for young elephants can be quite abusive, and whereby elephants are separated from their mothers, and then they're put through a kind of a weaning process where there's a kind of a love-hate, if you will, dynamic that's established between the young elephant and its captor. And that maybe potentially breaks down a certain resilience that elephants may have. It's essentially taming the beast. I mean, that's essentially the mentality and the approach of it. The reality is that elephants are very dangerous animals. Elephants do kill their mahouts quite often, more often than a lot of people realize. So when you are a mahout and you are working with an elephant, there is always that opportunity that that elephant might one day just decide that he or she doesn't like you anymore. So it's a kind of interesting, almost as Richard does describe it, interestingly, as like a contractual relationship. There's an understanding that the elephant recognizes the mahout or the captor as the way in which it gets its food, and so it knows that it has to have some kind of exchange with that captor in order to survive. Yet at the same time, you know, is there any kind of association or love relationship between the elephant and the mahout? That, again, we can't really possibly know from the elephant side. Certainly from the mahout side, there is. And that I can say firsthand, having spent so much time in Thailand and having seen so many traditional elephant families care for their elephants. And there is a love on that side. Sometimes I've described it to people as kind of like this sort of codependent bad marriage relationship where you've got, you know, the elephant on one side and the mahout on the other. And, you know, the mahout might be happy, but the elephant may not be so happy, but the elephant still has to kind of try to get along. So it's a very complex and fascinating relationship, which is what makes the story unique. And unlike, really, I believe, our relationships with any other creatures. I mean, our relationships with dogs and cats and horses and are through many generations of domestication. Elephants are not a domesticated species, and that's a really important thing for people to understand. Every elephant you see in captivity, even if it's born in captivity, is technically, genetically, a wild animal. They have not been altered over time through genetic selection, which is primarily what defines domestication of species. So you look at dogs as probably being the most domesticated species on the planet, cows, goats, horses. I mean, there's many, many examples of that. That's never happened with elephants. So you're always dealing with a wild animal, even in any of those captive circumstances. Nong Mai, the elephant who's in our film, who, you know, I spent almost 3 years in and around places with Nong Mai from the early days when we first met her and walk. I mean, she was just a three-year-old elephant. Following that difficult life in the streets of Bangkok to when she was released to the wild and spending time in these beautiful wild sanctuaries, interacting, watching Nong Mai from afar, always knowing Nong Mai is a wild animal. And this is why the reintroduction to wild habitats works so successfully for elephants. They reintroduce back to the wild quite easily, relatively speaking, in comparison to other animals, whether that's been attempted, such as lions or tigers or larger carnivores, animals that have different ways of interacting with their environments. But elephants, because they help each other, they're herbivores, because of their social emotional bonding, work together and learn and help each other remember, and of course they have very long memories, so they do remember how to exist in those environments. So that is a very interesting aspect of the elephant mind that I think is important for people to understand when we look at elephants in these captive circumstances. We don't know how it's been enabled that an elephant with all this intelligence and all of this strength would allow itself to kick a soccer ball or make a painting. Is there some element in that elephant psychology that has a sense of accomplishment, that has a sense of wanting to please its captor because of some kind of emotional dynamic that's part of their psychology? That's something that we don't know. So we look at it more from how elephants are trained, and we see that in most cases is what we would consider to be an abusive, a weaning separation process. And this, there's been a lot of attention put on this recently and how the various ranges of how this training process takes place, how that training process has really been accelerated in the last few decades, again, because of the popularity of elephants in tourism, because of the popularity of elephants in entertainment, circus-type environments, and this is worldwide. You know, elephants make money. There's a business around elephants in captivity, and everybody loves elephants. So if you're in the tourism industry, you're running a circus or whatever, you want to have an elephant. You want to have an elephant exhibit or an elephant show because you know it's going to attract lots of people. So there's been this real acceleration of the need for elephants in captive circumstances to bolster this tourism and entertainment industry. As a result, young elephants are captured from the wild, put into this training situation, and maybe done so much more quickly than in earlier times. Because this is actually one of the things that I researched, and it was very hard to find information about how elephants were trained like 200 years ago. Was it the same process, or was there a different process? And speaking with people like Richard Lair and others who've sort of studied more from an anthropology perspective, and just from the traditional knowledge of the ethnic peoples that are the elephant caretakers, the Gui people in Thailand, the Karen people, another ethnic group in northern Thailand, which is predominantly where that crush or fajan, and it's referred to, process happens, which is what you see in the film. And it was actually said from one of the elders that, in fact, in earlier times, The training process with elephants being separated from its you know, their mothers was much slower and much less brutal, that it was a much longer period of time where the young elephant learned to live with humans and learned from its mother how to interact with humans. And it went over a period of a few years, as opposed to what we've seen or said to have happened in cases now with young elephants being put through this training process that takes place just over a couple of weeks. So that's one of the big distinctions that I found very interesting in terms of, we look at the history of human-elephant relations, what were people doing a few hundred years ago? Because this is not a new relationship, as I've said. I mean, elephants have been around people for a long time, and vice versa. And I often say to people, too, that as much as we think we know about elephants, I also believe that elephants know a lot about us. So
I agree with that. They're very intelligent creatures.
That might be much deeper than we think.
Yes. Well, thank you so much. That was such a huge wealth of information, Patricia. We are out of time. Thank you for joining us on the show today to tell us about your new film, When Elephants Were Young, and shedding some light on what is happening with this situation. You can find out more about the film by visiting the website, whenelephantsweareyoung.com. And also, if you're in the Victoria area, you are invited to attend one of the three film screenings this Sunday, September the 18th at the UVic Cinecenta at 3:15, 5:15, and 7:15 p.m. And you'll be there too to give a talk, right, and answer questions.
Yes, I will. I'll be there doing a Q&A. And thank you so much, Allison, for this time. I really appreciate it. If people can't come out to see the film at Cinecenta this weekend, the film is also available online through iTunes, Google, or Amazon. So people can go to our website, whenelephantsweareyoung.com. They can see other places where the film is available. And all of the proceeds from the film support our organization, World Elephant Day, so that we can continue to do this work.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and have a great day.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, September 16th. And Allison, I think you can tell us a bit about what's going to go on then.
Next show is going to be a fun one. So it's going to be sort of a mishmash of different things that we want to chat about. One of the things that we'll be doing is we'll be having one of the organizers of the Thanksgiving leafleting and Earthlings experience that we were talking about. His name's Bernie Huber. He's been on the show before, and he's going to come in and speak about Kickstarter fundraiser campaign that he's putting on right now. He wants to print 10,000 of those brochures to be distributed to educate people on issues to do with Thanksgiving. And Caroline, I'm hoping you might talk about your business card outreach.
Oh, I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
Right on. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page as well, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. The musical piece we are closing with today is by cellist Jamie Sieber and is from the soundtrack of the film When Elephants Were Young. It is called A Love Song for Humanity. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.